Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this event. We have a story in England about a bishop who was visiting a parish hall. He'd been invited by the vicar to meet the parishioners, and when they entered the hall, there was only one person there, and the bishop said to the vicar, "Did you tell them I was coming?" And he said, "No, I didn't. But I think the word must have got out." Well, I think the word got out that you were coming, Jean-Claude, and we're delighted to have you here to give this lecture. And the Centre for Economic Performance is very proud that you should have agreed to come. Now, as everybody here knows, Mr. Trichet is a key figure in the new Europe that is coming into being. He's been for very many years one of the main advocates of the EMU, while at the same time defending the franc in the meantime. And I think that as the battle raged and the comings and goings occurred over the last 3 or 4 years, he was perhaps one of the most stable and reliable points that led to the more certain situation that we're in today. And when the history of the EMU comes to be written, he will emerge as one of the giants who created it. So we're very much looking forward to hearing what you have to say, and there will be time for questions afterwards. I should tell you that when we had Carl Otto Pearl here, I think it was about 6 or 7 years ago, he was rather rude about the British government, which was at that time proposing the hard EQ, and he took this occasion to put them down, but I'm sure you'll be more polite. But then we have a different government. So we're very much looking forward to hearing your talk, Jean-Claude Trichet.
Thank you very much, dear friend, for your invitation. And I don't know whether the word has passed or not on the audience, but I feel a very, very nice and I would say warm atmosphere here. Let me tell you that I might disappoint a little bit some of you because if you came for, I would say, some kind of scoops. And I would like to remind you a story with Alan Greenspan, chairman of the Federal Reserve. Once he was asked to come, not in the London Economic School, but in the Senate, in the US Senate, for some hearings. And he was asked a very indiscreet question of the sort, are the interest rate likely to increase during the next meeting of the Open Market Committee? And he embarked into a very nice response during a quarter of an hour, with the inventory cycle on the one hand, the household behavior on the other hand, the very delicate and touchy balance between the upside possibilities and downside possibilities and so forth and so forth. And he stopped. The senator said, "Well, Chairman, I understand that you will increase rates." And Alan said, "Senator, if you think that you have understood what I just said, I probably made a mistake somewhere." So, only to say that I am a central banker and not a professor, and that you might be full of, I would say, compassion for what I will try to tell you, knowing that, of course, we have some... I would say, way of trying to be as discreet in our response as possible, even if the questions that are implicitly or explicitly asked are there. Indiscreet, of course. Let me make a series of points. I don't want to read a paper because I think it's less appropriate in such an atmosphere. First of all, I would like only to tell you that I am fully confident that the Euro will take place the 1st January 1999. Nothing new in that, of course. And you know pretty well, dear friend, that I have said that a lot of times ago, but I think that it is worth restating that I have full confidence that it will come into force, and I have full confidence that it will come into force with the full meeting of the Maastricht criteria. And the Maastricht criteria are, in my opinion, absolutely of the essence. They have been presented from time to time as orthodox criteria or ultra-orthodox criteria. It was fashionable 3 years ago or 4 years ago to look at the criteria as if they were really born out an ultra-orthodoxy coming from continental Europe. I think it is absolutely untrue, and I will try to present you all the reason why it seems to me that those criteria are the best way to respond to the pertinent questions that are asked when you are speaking of the single currency endeavor. And my second point precisely is to try to explain why we in Europe have tried to respond as pertinently as possible to those criticisms, which are, I would say, appropriate criticism theoretically, and the main criticism being, and you know it pretty well, you are embarking on a single currency when you have no federal government and no federal budget. And therefore, and these are probably the two main criticisms I hear very frequently, first of all, how will you ensure that you have an appropriate policy mix in an area where there is no federal budget, and where the national budgets are in the hands of the various parliaments and governments? And second criticism, which is also very strong and I would say has to be responded, how would you ensure that there is some kind of automatic stabilizers if there is an asymmetric shock in part of the single currency area where you have, again, not a federal budget? And to take the metaphor of the United States of America, in the United States of America, it is clear that to embark on an appropriate policy mix, it's in the hands of the government and the parliament and the Congress in the domain of the fiscal policy, and it, of course, in the domain of the Federal Reserve System, in the domain of the monetary policy. And when we have in California, say, a particular problem with an asymmetric shock, then the taxation that is got out of California will diminish with the diminishing of the GDP of California. When the transfers going to California will continue on the same footing, this is the automatic stabilizer that you have in an area which is a federation, a political federation. What is the response of the European? Precisely, we have in the Maastricht Treaty and implemented or expressed in an I would say operational way in the Stability and Growth Pact, all what the Europeans have found out to try to respond to those questions, in my opinion, pertinently. First of all, as you know, we have introduced into the Maastricht Treaty elements in the fiscal side that are extremely constraining. And again, it seems to me that it was absolutely necessary because we had no federal budget. So we had to take the addition, the summing up of the various national budgets as the pertinent entity. It was on the addition of the national budget that we had to try to see whether or not we would have an appropriate policy mix in the area. And that's the reason why we have those inbuilt, enshrined in the Maastricht Treaty, a series of constraints, again, namely the possibility for the Council in Europe, that is the meeting of the governments, to ask a particular nation, a particular member country, to redress a situation which, if, in case that situation appears to be deviating for an appropriate behavior, if that particular country does not redress the situation, as you know, it is possible, again, for the peers to ask, I would say publicly, with a deadline, for decisions to be taken. If those decisions are not taken, it is possible to embark into a series of sanctions: ineligibility to the EIB credit, the possibility or the imposition on a particular country to make non-interest-bearing deposit, the possibility to embark on fines if, after all those recommendations and these sanctions, we have a country which continues not to behave properly in the eyes of the Maastricht Treaty, in the eyes of the peers that are the judges in the circumstances. So it seems to me that if one consider that there is more power in the hands of the Council, that is the collège of the governments in Europe, on a particular member state in the fiscal area, than there is any power in the hands of the federal government of the US, or in the Congress of the US, or in the federal government of Germany, or in the Swiss Confederation, against any particular state in the US, land in Germany, or canton in Switzerland, one can see that we have treated carefully, very carefully, I would say, and not with benign neglect, that particular question of the policy mix in Europe. We have given more power to the center in Europe than is given to the center in any political federation that you could find out the world over. We have not treated the problem of the policy mix with benign neglect, and we have treated in the only way which was possible for us, because we don't have a federation, we don't have a political federation, therefore the power is in the hands of the collège of the various governments, the collège, the meeting of the various governments. It's the only way to proceed in Europe, because it is there that is, in Europe, the, I would say, political legitimacy. Not only it seems to me that we have treated seriously the question of the policy mix, but it seems also to me that we have treated seriously the question of the resistance to asymmetric shock as regards the fiscal policy. In a US audience, and I'm not in a US audience, but I know that there are a lot of US citizens here, I utilize a metaphor which seems to work, so I'll try it here. I say that in the Maastricht Treaty and in the Stability and Growth Pact, we have inbuilt an automatic reloading of the fiscal gun. That is, in normal time, we are supposed to post a balanced budget or a budget in surplus. And that is what is said in the Stability and Growth Pact. That is what has been said by heads and states and government when they decided to embark on the Stability and Growth Pact. In normal times, we are supposed to post a balanced budget or a budget in surplus. Nothing to be surprised. I mean, it's a global motto today. In the US, there is a bipartisan accord to consider that it is appropriate to post the balanced budget. You know that pretty well. It is the same in Europe. But it is the same with the control of the peers, if I may. The peers' control is also there. And if you consider that we have inbuilt in the treaty this automatic reloading of this fiscal gun, then when there is an asymmetric shock in country X or Y, it is possible, according to our own rules, to fire at least 3% of, I would say, fiscal deficit in order to cope with the asymmetric shock that is observed in this particular state. And I don't speak of exceptional circumstances. I'm speaking of normal circumstances where you can have that possibility of firing, again, 3% of fiscal deficit, national fiscal deficit. Of course, I could also embark on some, I would say, indication of what is possible apart from the single currency endeavor in Europe. You have the structural funds, you have the cohesion fund, so you have, as well as in other entities or federations, you have also possibility of transfers, but only in the fiscal side and only looking at what is in the Stability and Growth Pact, you have an element of resistance, if I may, to possible asymmetric shocks. And of course, you can fight your 3% of GDP deficit without having particular problem in the monetary side, without having particular problem in the financing of your balance of payments. If it appears to be difficult because the situation is difficult, you have no particular problem in the interest rate side. So again, I think that when you look at the Maastricht Treaty in the fiscal area, you can either consider, and it's in my opinion a wrong view, that it is very orthodox. Some said ultra-orthodox, they don't say it now, fortunately. You can also say that you are giving to a supranational entity a lot of influence, including possible sanctions on the various nation states. But you can, and in my opinion, it's the wrong way to look at it, because you have to recognize, in my opinion, that on the contrary, you have treated in the best fashion possible that very, very important problem, which was, namely, how do you treat the question of an appropriate policy mix when you have no federal budget and no federal political organization. Of course, you can consider all what I have said as an introduction to very, very pertinent questions and maybe also in this field, very indiscreet questions. I'm open, of course, to any question. The other point I would like to make is the following. I think it's very, very important to understand that in Europe today, we are not operating in the single currency endeavor along a concept of averaging, but we are operating along a concept of benchmarking. To understand what we are doing in Europe today in the monetary area, it seems to me that we have to look at it under two different grids. One grid is what I would call the quantitative aspects of the endeavor. In terms of quantity, we are adding GDPs, we are adding monetary aggregates, we are adding trade, we are adding external trade, and we are creating an entity of, I would say, a great magnitude. To oversimplify, we are creating an entity which will have the size of the other entity, which is the United States of America. That is the quantity, adding up various quantities. But there is also another grid to look at what we are doing, and it is the, I would say, scale of qualities. What are we doing in terms of qualities? Are we producing the weighted average of the various qualities that are in Europe? No, we are not doing that. We have decided to benchmark and to see where the best behaviors, the best qualities, and to ask others to align on the best qualities. Even the criteria in the Maastricht Treaty are based upon this idea. What are we doing when inflation criteria is at stake? We are looking at the three best performers, computing the average of the three best performers and computing the differential between all others and the three best performers. What are we doing in terms of long-term interest rates? Again, we look at the long-term rates that go with the three best performers in terms of inflation, and we compute the differential with the three best performers. In terms of monetary or currency stability, it is also, of course, implicitly the best performers that are benchmarks to measure the stability of the currency. And of course it is also the fact in terms of fiscal position, whereby it's been clearly said that the bad behavior had to converge toward more appropriate ranges of fiscal deficit. So all what we are doing is based upon this idea that we are benchmarking. And that has an important consequence, it seems to me, in terms of currency. What is absolutely clear is that the euro must and will have the legacy of credibility, solidity, of inbuilt confidence that exists in the best currencies in Europe today, what I would call the legacy of the benchmark currencies today. It is precisely what the treaty has called for. It is clearly what we've been doing over time. It is also what is in the best interest of all parties concerned. It is obvious that it would be absolutely out of any common sense to ask a particular economy to exchange its own good, solid, credible currency against a currency which would be less credible, less solid, less confidence-inspiring. And it would certainly present to that particular economy an instrument which would be less appropriate than the previous one. But equally, in the other countries which have not yet necessarily got to the best quality in terms of confidence or solidity or credibility of the currency, it is, of course, in their best interest that when they are on their way to the convergence process, they don't stop at some kind of average level of credibility and confidence, but they go up to the best level possible, which would also correspond, of course, to the best level of confidence and the lowest level of long-term market rates, to take the criteria of Maastricht. So again, I think it's very important, and it is one of my messages, if I may. The convergence exercise in Europe is not a convergence exercise towards an average position in terms of quality. It's a convergence exercise towards the benchmark position in terms of quality. Another point I would like to make, because I think it's also very important, and again it's part of the possible, pertinent questions that are asked on the endeavor in which the Europeans have embarked on, is the question of the structural reforms. I sometimes hear the remark which says, well, you have embarked into a single currency endeavor, which might be appropriate or might not, depending on the position of the various circles. But in any case, you have to embark into structural reforms that are of the essence in Europe, and you are concentrating too much efforts in the domain of the single currency, and that is an energy which is dissipated in this area and which is not concentrated in the domain of the structural reform. And it seems to me, my thesis is that the instead of being, I would say, contradictory, the two endeavors are complementary. And I'll try to explain that. The single currency endeavor is, in many aspects, the coronation of the single market endeavor, because you'll have a single market functioning in a much better fashion, of course, with this single currency. Only fancy what would happen in the US if there was different currency, there were different currencies into Massachusetts, Florida, and California. We will have perhaps a single market, but certainly a single market of a very different nature in comparison with what we observe today in the United States. So, in a way, the single currency is really the last very, very big step in the direction of an appropriate single market. And the single market in itself has called for very important structural reform and calls for very important structural reforms. And in my opinion, the single currency endeavor will facilitate the structural reforms, will call for structural reforms, and will certainly not in any respect be contradictory with the structural reforms that are needed, and that are needed, of course, for a number of reasons, the most important reason being that a very large part of the unemployment is structural. And I'm only quoting there the OECD or the IMF or all international expertise, which are usually saying, and I trust that it is probably appropriate and pertinent, that maybe up to 80% of the unemployment that is observed today in some countries in Europe, in my country or in Germany, or in countries that are close to geographically, like Spain or Belgium and so forth, we have there certainly a very, very large part, a part of unemployment which is due to structural impediments. And again, the fact that we embark in the single currency will certainly not prevent us from doing the appropriate and necessary structural reforms, but in my opinion will help doing those structural reforms, because we will have not only all the analysis that we can have today on the necessity of the structural reforms and of the necessity of embarking in those directions to produce, I would say, a process of job creation which would be more active, but we will also have the inbuilt impetus given by the single currency endeavor. These are, of course, only introductions to the question that you would like to embark on. Let me tell you as a conclusion that, in my opinion, we have a lot, of course, of other points that we have to examine at the level of Europe. And I have only quoted a series of, but a small number of criticism, namely in the domain of the structural reforms that are needed or in the domain of the fiscal position. But one could, of course, see a lot of others. And I very often hear that we don't have the labor flexibility that would be required in a single currency area. And that is observed in the United States of America. I very often observe that it is said that the physical mobility of workers is much more inferior in Europe, as it again it is observed in other areas in the world. And I must say I hesitate myself to qualify exactly the situation. It seems to me that we might underestimate the labor mobility that we have observed in Europe over the past years. To take only the example of my own country, more than 35% of the French citizens today are sons or grandsons of foreigners. And it is the case of my own sons, but it is the case again of 35% approximately of the French citizens, which probably puts us at the level of the US, and I hesitate, but maybe even more than the US themselves. And a lot, of course, of those foreigners are coming from Europe. I mean, a lot of French citizens are sons or grandsons of Italians, of Portuguese, of Spanish people. And this means that we have had in Europe a great, great dimension of labor movements. And again, I think that we might be more flexible than one usually thinks in this respect. I have also to say that even in the U.S. today, it would be, in my opinion, a little bit an over-exaggeration to say that a lot of people are taking their mobile homes and driving over thousands of kilometers like in Grapes of Wrath. It's a little bit different. Capital is more mobile. And when it appears that there are places where you have labor, a lot of labor possibilities, then the capital goes there. From, I don't know, Massachusetts to South Carolina, or from Massachusetts to Florida, or the reverse, or from California back to Wyoming. And it seems to me that in Europe we are observing exactly the same. The dimension of the capital movements that are observed in Europe today are absolutely, clearly of the same magnitude as those you might observe in the United States. And not to speak of my own country or your country, when you look at the capital which goes in Portugal, which goes in Ireland, which goes in other countries, you can see clearly that this phenomena are operating, and I don't see exactly why it should be, I would say, very different in our future Europe as it is from what we are observing today and what is observed also in the United States of America. So again, I think that we should not overestimate, which is very often done, the, I would say, de facto, historical and present capacity of mobility, both for the capital and also for the people of Europe. And particularly, and you will say that, of course, it's probably an appropriate concluding remark in this environment here, but the young generation, and I can see that by all the young generation, which the young people which I know, the young generation don't consider that they are frontiers anymore. And they go where they want to go. And the, I would say, psychological dimension of mobility is totally different for the new generation that it was before. And it seems to me again that there we are very likely to experience in Europe a level of flexibility in that sense, which we are probably, or some are probably underestimating in my mind. I wanted to only, as I said, to introduce some of the questions, but I signal that I have a written speech which will be available in any case, and I'm ready to respond to any question in the Allen's way, if you permit me. It's one of those questions which I could put in the category of the very indiscreet questions. I will say the following. First of all, it seems to me that the responsibility of those central banks that are running what I would call currencies that, according to the yield curve that everybody can observe, are in that group of core currencies I've just been mentioning. And you might set up the list yourself. My own currency is certainly part of this core currency group, which is fortunately not only good in quality, if I may, but also big in quantity, which is certainly also an element that we must have in mind. That being said, it seems to me that our responsibility is to continue to operate our own monetary policy, taking account of our own,
I would say, monetary policy need, because we, at this stage, have the responsibility of passing on the euro the legacy of what we have accumulated. So I will say that the best way of looking at the euro is to look at those currencies that have presently merged their yield curve and to say, well, the euro will come out of the merging of those currencies. And we will see what we will have to do, taking account all the elements. And I would say the past is the best possible grid to analyze what we will do in the future. We still have 14 months of, decisions that have to be taken through our own monetary policy councils or central bank councils or whatever. We will continue, and in my case, in the case of the Council of Monetary Policy of the Banque de France, we will continue to operate according to the same rules that we have observed during the last years, and we will see exactly what is called for. I trust, personally, that we are in a business cycle in my own country, which is encouraging. We consider that we are in phases of picking up of the production. We will see exactly what happens. I don't trust for the time being that what's happening here and there could have an important bearing on the business cycle in continental Europe, but we will see again what happens. In any case, we will do whatever is needed to keep our own currency exactly on the same tracks that it had previously. And it is the best service we can pay to the euro, passing on the euro, this legacy of credibility.
As regards the frequency of various data, I'm not sure that we are lagging behind the US. It might be the coherence of the various data, because of course we had various national traditions, and it seems to me that part of the European endeavor, a very important part, and certainly a very important part in the domain of the monetary policy, is to merge precisely the various indicators in order to have an homogeneous view of what's happening in each part of, in each country, in each member country of the single currency to all, and even, of course, today, in the single market of today, and to be able, merging those various indicators, to produce pertinent indicators at the level of the Union itself. I don't know whether Alan has criticized what we are producing. He has also, in my memory, said that some improvements could be made also in the US. So it seems to me that we have all to work. And it is true that we have a special challenge, which is the various national traditions of each of our countries. Even in the domain of the CPI, which would look not too complicated a priori, you know pretty well that we are comparing CPIs that are quite different. And I'm always struck, personally, when I look at the production which is made at the level of the European Union itself on the homogenized CPIs, where you see that there is a lot of apparent differential of big magnitude that appear to be much meager when you really put exactly the same inputs in the various CPIs. And the convergence in terms of inflation, which has been absolutely striking over the last years, and I would say in some respect highly unexpected, even by the authors of the Maastricht Treaty, is even
more important when you look at the homogeneous indicators. You see that practically all countries in Europe are in a very, very thin range of CPI, and that proves that we have to work on each of our national indicators to be sure that we are progressively speaking of the same things, which is not yet entirely the case. The I would say core of the reasoning is convergence. We are supposed to integrate in a single currency area economies that have sufficiently converged. And that's the reason why my first remark was the Maastricht criteria are absolutely of the essence. Benchmarking works if you are effectively converging towards the benchmark. And I don't want to quote any particular country, if you permit me. You have quoted some countries. I will not quote any country myself, but I will say, let's beware of, I would say, optical illusion. Some countries that are part of the European Union have still a standard of living which is lower than the standard of living of Britain or France or Germany and so forth. These countries are in a process of catching up. So what you can observe might be from time to time only the fact that even being at the same phases of the business cycle, there is a process of catching up. And you cannot necessarily judge that various economies are in different business cycles only by some differential in terms of GDP growth, for instance. But I trust, on the basis of all what I have observed, that, say, to oversimplify again, and you will forgive me, continental Europe is in the same business cycle. Continental Europe is in the same business cycle. And to give you some figures that have struck me when I recomputed them, when I look at Germany and France, which are the two biggest economies in this area, the differential between the annual rate of growth in volume terms in Germany and in France since 94, we had a recession in 93 in continental Europe, since 94 has never been more than 0.2% each year. And when you add up the growth of all years, 94, 95, 96, 97, and if you compute also 98, but if you stop to 97, the differential is only 0.1%. The compound growth over this period of 3 or 4 or 5 years. So we really are in the same business cycle, and I don't think that we have, from that standpoint, a particular difficulty, apart from what I call the catching up, which seems to me perfectly possible to digest in the process that I was mentioning of benchmarking.
it is an allusion to the so-called Euro-X. Is that the question? The informal meeting of ministers of the Eurozone. No, I No, the response is very clear. The response is in the treaty. The European Central Bank is inflexibly independent. I would say as well as Banque de France. Banque de France is inflexibly independent, and it is also called by the treaty. National central banks have to be absolutely independent. And it is one of the criteria of Maastricht. You cannot join the single currency area if you don't have a national central bank fully, totally independent. It is also the case for the ECB, of course. And I would say that when I was the witness, I didn't participate at all, and Hans Sittmeier neither, to the discussions between ministers on that particular point. But we observed together that both ministers said, we will propose something like informal meetings, and they have said publicly both, without any prejudice to the inflexible independence of the European Central Bank, and without prejudice to the powers of the Council itself, the Council of the 15, which is in the treaty and has powers according to the treaty. No, you're absolutely right. If you don't reload the fiscal gun, then you cannot fire. That's clear. And that's the reason why I'm a strong advocate of the Stability and Growth Pact. And I trust that it is very, very important that the heads of states and government have said precisely that in normal times, you had to be balanced. Again, it's not something extraordinary. It's considered absolutely, without saying, in the U.S. It was not necessarily the case, say, 3 or 4 years ago. But fortunately, it seems to me that we have now worked out some kind of global consensus in this respect. But you're absolutely right. There is always the possibility of not behaving properly, and there we have the series of amicable pressure I was mentioning during my previous exposition. But you're right, we have to understand that, but I'm sure that here everybody would agree with that, that to be wise in the management of the fiscal position is, of course, something which is good for the economy, which is good for growth, which is good for job creation, and it is the profound trust of the central banks in general.
This is my industry question. Maybe you can give a better answer than Alan Greenspan. if you take a country that has decided not to enter in the first round, but has said that in principle it wants to enter and it will enter at the right time, what actions should such a country be taking, and what are the main dangers which such a country is facing?
I think that you have overpassed all criteria, all possible criteria in terms of indiscretion in the question. And of course you have Eddie George very close to this beautiful room, so I would. Yeah, and Mervyn there. Oh, you're. Well, then I will pass on them the appropriate response. But what I would say, I understand that
the position is that the so-called criteria are also inspiring, and that they can perfectly well be more or less shadowed during that period of time which you've been mentioning. But I would only say that as a conclusion, but it's not on the case of that particular country, which I have still a difficulty to identify. But no, I would say, even, and that's really something which is very profound, it seems to me, even if we didn't have the Maastricht Treaty, even if we didn't have the idea of a single currency, in my own country, I trust that if we would like to embark into the best possible policy for the sake of the nation, we would pursue the same monetary policy, stability-oriented monetary policy, and we would pursue the same policy in terms of reduction of the fiscal imbalances. Because, and I would say on top of that also the structural reforms that are needed, but it seems to me that we are not, and it is a very, very strong belief, at least for me, we are not sacrificing anything on the altar of Europe. We are doing things because they are going in the right direction for the sake of the country itself, and it is very happily that it goes exactly in the direction of the European endeavor, of the European construction. But there is no contradiction there, and I have to say it's only in the circles that are very, very profoundly against Europe that this thesis, according to which there is a contradiction between the interest of Europe and the interest of the nation, and they collide, and therefore we have to pay, for those who have embarked into the European construction, a high price on the altar, again, of Europe, I think it's absolutely untrue, personally. I think that fundamentals are the underlying forces that are producing stability or instability. I have said a lot of times that I was profoundly happy to see that there was a global, some kind of global consensus, for instance, on stability in terms of fiscal position. And I see also, and I trust, that we have an enormous deal of convergence in the monetary policies that are pursued on the two sides of the Atlantic. So I'm very confident, provided, of course, this convergence continue to be observed, that we will observe the kind of stability in the relationship between the various currencies that has been observed till now. I don't trust that the creation of the euro per se will immediately profoundly change the relationship. It seems to me that, again, as I said, the euro will have the legacy of the best currencies in Europe, and you'll see that there is a continuity between those currencies and the euro. Again, I trust that there will not be an immense change overnight, and that progressively we will see the new equilibrium appear. But again, my trust is that if we are running in both sides of the Atlantic wise policies, we are very, very likely to observe, I would say, appropriate stability in the floating exchange system. If we are running policies that would contradict, or if one of the sides of the Atlantic, which I don't trust at all, would embark into absence of wise policies there, you could be worried.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I think we've had a wonderful evening. Jean-Claude, actually, I don't think he's really been taxed very heavily in your questioning, which I think must mean that he's persuaded you of this project. At least I personally very much hope that he has persuaded people. I have always found his presentations on this subject incredibly impressive, I must say, and I think that everybody here must have had that same feeling. There is a curious opinion around the place in some quarters in England that somehow this thing is not going to be run by competent people, and that's above all why I wanted to have Jean-Claude to come and give us this talk, because I think you've only to see the kind of people who are going to be running this new European monetary policy to see that it's a competent club to join. And personally, I'm rather enthusiastic, and I hope that Jean-Claude has raised your enthusiasm too. I believe he has, and thank you very much, Jean-Claude.